Today's Between the Rows podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Gowan Canada, the go-to company. Gowan's herbicide portfolio includes Avidex and Fortress, which control Group 1 and Group 2 resistant wild oats. Don't let wild oats rob your yields. Use Avidex and Fortress to stop them in their tracks. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator alerts us to the potential for flooding in Manitoba this spring.
The potential for overland flooding is estimated as a, quote, moderate to major in most areas of the province.
Mike Rain of the Western Producer gives us an inside look at the benefits of growing winter wheat.
Once you're into the pattern of doing it, you start to see the benefits. I think until this year, the previous three seasons saw winter wheat as one of the highest net margin crops that a producer can grow.
And Phil France-Workington of Commodity News Service Canada takes a look at the markets.
Margins are a bit tighter, but they're still, you know, they're some of the lowest of the past year, but if you look out over 10 years or something, they're still very good.
All this on Between the Rows with this week's host, Laura Rance.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows, a weekly podcast by Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. Flooding and springtime often go hand in hand in Manitoba, and it's looking like this spring's going to be no exception. Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator has been talking to municipal officials about how they're getting ready for it. Hi, Lorraine. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. You're welcome.
I understand the people in Wawanisa area of southwestern Manitoba got a glimpse of possible things to come this spring. What happened?
Well, on the 31st of January, a portion of Stewart River's bank just outside the village of Wawanisa collapsed. I understand that isn't all that unusual, but it does tend to happen when there's heavy snowfall on top of saturated ground, which causes the soil underneath it to loosen and give away. So officials out that way said a 10-meter high portion of the bank that fell into the river was probably weakened in the past year or so by higher than usual precipitation and groundwater levels, and then plus the effect of erosion from floodwaters of the past years. So the collapse temporarily cut a fiber optic cable that provided internet and phone service to villages of Glenboro and Cypress River. I haven't heard of any more problems from it. They are expecting that this big pile of dirt in the river will start to wash downstream as spring comes on, but of course everyone is now watching the calendar and the forecast as spring approaches.
I guess what it is telling them is that there is some severely saturated soil going into the spring thaw. So how big is the flood risk?
Well, the province issued what is called a conditions report about 2 weeks ago. That was January the 30th, which is somewhat earlier than they usually do that. And it, in fact, came out because of those high soil moisture conditions and the snowfall that we've had so far. That report said the potential for overland flooding is estimated as, quote, moderate to major in most areas of the province. The actual risk depends, of course, on weather conditions between now and the spring melt. So the main things that everyone's keeping an eye on, but of course can't predict at this point, is whether we get more snow, lots of spring rain, and how fast the snow melts. And the depth of the frost and various river and lake levels prior to spring runoff will, of course, also be factors.
So are people thinking 2011 type of flooding?
I think they don't know what to expect just yet, but it is fair to say they're bracing for another hit. The local leaders that I talked to said they do expect flooding, localized or otherwise. So they're just being very watchful and they're getting ready as best as they can, and they're just trying to stay as informed as they can about changing conditions. One thing in some towns' favor, of course, now, and just speaking specifically about southwestern Manitoba, is that places like Melitta and Souris and Wawanisa, they now have dikes around them to protect against water elevations to those 2011 levels.
And that's since 2011.
Yeah, so okay. There's less concern that direction in the towns and villages about the impact on water treatment and wastewater treatment plants. And, of course, permanent diking gives flood fighters some advantage, but, of course, farmland is extremely vulnerable. And, I mean, out in the far southwest, everybody around there remembers the conditions of 2014 when the village of Pearson and surrounding farms that direction, they just became virtual islands in this surreal landscape of swamp and submerged farmland. And
what are people telling?
Were washed out and roads were washed out. So, yeah, people don't want to see that again.
What are people telling you about how things have changed? I mean, we're actually seeing incidents after a heavy rainstorms that of flash flooding type of conditions in southwestern Manitoba. What are the people saying about how the changes they've seen in the last few years?
Well, they see more water coming and they see it moving a lot faster. They experience, people talk about these sort of flash floods after a heavy rainstorm. You know, some of that is talked about as being the result of unregulated drainage to the west. But, you know, I've listened to some very interesting presentations about this this flow of water. And I remember one scientist last fall speaking about how really the entire hydrology of all of Western Canada is changing as the climate gets warmer. So we get more intense rainstorms with a warmer climate. You know, again, I've heard scientists say that what we're really seeing is faster-paced water flowing across the landscape. It's coming from glacial melt out of the Canadian Rockies, and it's coming from this intensification of atmospheric conditions. I heard this very interesting presentation about what scientists refer to now as the aerial rivers, which they've been able to detect with satellite technology. But these are just swaths in the atmosphere. They carry more water as global temperatures go up, and they can be thousands of miles long. So, you know, when we get a heavy rainstorm, that's part of what's contributing to the flow of water on the ground. So it's not just rivers and tributaries and drains on the ground that's changing how water flows across the landscape.
It's a lot more complex in terms of how that whole, as you say, the hydrological situation is changing. But how do people get prepared for this then? What are they doing in the rural areas?
Well, you can say that municipalities, districts have learned a lot from the past already. So they're working at being prepared both for short-term events and for long-term flood mitigation. There's been a lot of work done over the past, oh, I would say 5 years to try to mitigate the impacts of floods. And I could talk to you for a long time about the work that's been done, for example, by conservation districts in Manitoba. They've been developing these integrated watershed management plans, which is just means planning for water retention and water management over large areas. There's been lots of small dams built in the last few years to hold back water and slow the flow of it. But as for short-term planning, well, right now, municipalities that know they could be affected or they're counting their road closed signs and their barricades, and they're building up their inventories of sandbags, and of course they're reviewing their emergency response plans.
When will we know more about what's coming at us this spring?
The province will issue its first flood outlook towards the end of February.
Well, thanks, Lorraine. You can read more about this story in the February 9th issue of the Manitoba Cooperator, and we'll be following this story very closely as the spring thaw starts to unfold. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance. Coming up later in the show, we'll be talking to Phil Franz Workington of Commodity News Service Canada about what's hot and what's not in the grain markets. But first, Mike Rain, Managing Editor of the Western Producer, is here to talk about some new developments in winter wheat. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Great to be here. Winter wheat, may not be one of the hottest items on everybody's list, but it's maybe it should be.
Well, that's what I understand, is that there's some people that are saying it should be more popular than it is right now. What's been going on?
Well, research has been, steady when it comes to wheat in general. Of course, research has been somewhat more limited than some of the other crops that make up the prairie system. But when it comes to winter wheat, it's still going on out there, and there's some new varieties coming into the market. Of course, these things, from the time somebody starts making selections until we actually see it arrive, is a decision that was made 15 years ago.
Right.
But there is some both new varieties and we're seeing some research surrounding agronomy that's changing some of what might be producers' perceptions around the crop.
Well, let's just step back for a minute and just describe for me some of the jobs that winter wheat can do in a crop rotation.
Well, when you think about it, as anybody's thinking of trying to make better use of their machinery, so whether it's machinery utility or better use of the labor, labor is always a big issue around the farm. And if you're trying to make even better use of your land base, the fall seeded crops have an ability to kind of start the combines rolling at the end of July instead of waiting for the end of August. And for that reason alone, that creates opportunities to make better use of equipment and other resources. But, of course, that also leads into the issue of seeding during harvest, because just about the time you're swathing canola or trying to take off some pulse crops, of course, the issue of, I need to get the air seeder out and start planning to get that winter wheat in the ground.
There's a real time management issue. I mean, on one hand, it's an advantage because you're able to spread your resources out. But as you say, you're right in the middle of harvest and you're having to think about seeding.
As a confirmed winter wheat grower, I can say that it all seems like a really good idea till seeding time. But once you're into the pattern of doing it, you start to see the benefits. I think until this year, the previous three seasons saw winter wheat as one of the highest net margin crops that a producer can grow. And a lot of it has to do with that agronomy advantage. Number one, when other crops are still thinking about making flag, these things are coming out of the boot. So your spraying is moved around, and in some cases, crops are canopying in about the time that you have to start thinking about other weed control normally. And that creates an opportunity to both reduce the amount of time in the sprayer and potentially avoid stuff like wheat midge, which, of course, causes significant issues on the prairies in various areas from in any given year. So we see, true advantages to both saving money and producing higher yields and a premium quality crop.
Then why haven't farmers been planting more of it?
I think in part it comes down to cereals in a rotation. Leading up to the 15 years prior to 2007, that created a lot of producers just trying to get by without having to make any sudden moves. The margins were very tight. And after that, of course, we moved into almost a canola wheat rotation, not unlike a corn and beans that we see south of the border, because everything made money. Winter wheat was start acreage actually when we look back at the numbers was really starting to grow in the prairies prior to 2008. We saw, I think Manitoba saw its one of the largest crops at about a million tons in 2008, Saskatchewan was also up there in numbers, and even Alberta was at the same time. Farmers were growing more of it because they were starting to see the advantage. However, years after that, including some of the very wet years, caused producers to either not consider it as a crop because, again, all their spring crops were making money, or there's the issue surrounding when it comes right down to it. Do you want to interfere with what's been working for you? However, in terms of profitability, it remains one of the more profitable cereals.
So how are the researchers trying to address some of the agronomic issues that farmers are facing with winter wheat?
Research, they've been looking at some pretty important stuff when it comes down to it. One of the simple pieces that isn't, you know, might not seem so simple. You don't want to be seeding it in August. That's typically you want it to be in ahead of a crop insurance deadline. That varies across the prairies, but most people that grow it prefer to have it in the ground by the 15th of September. Turns out that research is pointing in another direction, saying, you know what, the overall yield is not necessarily impeded by later seeding. Now, we've had some open falls. However, researchers are saying no. As we move it towards October, that doesn't seem to be a big issue. And for lots of producers, that helps free up that seeding window.
So that implies that there might be some pressure on the crop insurance agencies to extend that fall seeding window.
Absolutely. And the data so far is pointing in a direction that says they need to start to rethink that approach. It turns out that the crops are more plastic than people thought when it comes to establishment, and then winter kill as well. In fact, the data shows that seeding that earlier seeding in August is not really working out. That's actually causing some yield loss.
So do you get the feeling that some of the farm organizations are going to take this and run with it?
I expect they will. I would think that advice to be planting more wheat, especially as we're producing a lot of utility wheats. The idea of winter wheat is probably makes a lot of sense. The yield is there. It's generally a high-yielding product. You're able to save some money in the production cycle. One of the other things that they've been looking at is the idea, do I put all that fertilizer, can I get away with putting all that fertilizer on in one pass in the fall? And if not, when should I apply it, and should I apply all of the rest of it in one pass in the spring? And it turns out the answer is spring. And while you can do a great job with a few products, things like Super U or ESN, can do very well in a single shot, and at the time of seeding, it's pointing to again to being able to apply good old urea in the spring when the crop needs it the most. Put it all on and let the fall seeded cereals take over.
Well, thanks for joining us to talk about this, Mike. You can read more about this story in the January 26th issue of The Western Producer. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rantz. Joining me now is Phil Franz-Workington of Commodity News Service Canada for a look at the grain markets this week. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Laura.
It looks like canola's had a pretty good run over the past couple of weeks. What's the story there?
It has had a good run for the past 2 weeks or the first couple weeks of February, but as of Friday, it's run into some resistance now, and it's been turning lower the past couple days, looking like the highs might be in for the time being.
Any idea of just what's been the major influence on that?
I guess you can blame U.S. soy complex on one hand, and just general chart signals. Fund traders added pretty big long positions, and now they're just going back on the other side and booking profits, selling those longs, booking profits on them. So prices are trending down a bit, And beyond the technicals, we've also got South America is starting to harvest their large soybean crop.
And so we're seeing the export prices come down, and what, I mean, what's happening on the crush side of things for canola?
The crush side on canola, crush margins are coming down, so that means the profitability of the crushers is coming down. They're still making, using the ICE Canada's numbers, $90 or so per ton crush margin, but that compares to $130 a month ago, so they're making $40 less for every ton of canola they buy. That said, the numbers coming out from the Canadian Oilseed Processors Association, they put out data on how much canola is being crushed every week in the country. It's still running at record levels, so they haven't. Their margins are coming down, but they're still working all out for now.
There's been a lot of canola that went into storage in poor condition in the fall that's been going into the crush market. So you see that demand continuing to be high, even though the margins might be a bit tighter?
Yes, definitely. The margins are a bit tighter. But they're still, you know, they're some of the lowest of the past year. But if you look out over 10 years or something, they're still very good. So and they're not going to just shut down. And at the same time, I guess it should be noted, while the official margins have come down, everything they're processing now is based on contracts signed months ago. So what the processors are actually seeing for their bottom line is likely quite different than what the, you know, current today market signals may be.
You mentioned the South American harvest in terms of soybeans having an influence on canola markets. Have they got a big crop coming in?
They do have a big crop coming in. Brazil and Argentina, they're the two big countries that are always being watched. There's been weather issues of some sort or another through the growing seasons in both areas. It's too wet in Argentina for a while there, too dry as well in other areas. But Brazil's starting their harvest now, and the kind of day-to-day, oh, it's too wet today, it's too dry today weather forecast. They have a bit of an influence on the prices now, but overall, they're still going to be big crops out of both countries, and that means once they're available, export demand shifts from North America to South America because their beans are usually going for cheaper than our canola or the American soybeans.
And it sounds like they're not the only ones having a big crop this year. What's happening in Australia?
Australia has got bumper crops across the board on just about everything. So they, as far as we're concerned here in Canada, the canola, they've got the second largest canola crop on record, according to the latest numbers out yesterday from the Australian Agricultural Bureau. Their canola is a lot closer to China and the Asian markets than ours is, so that conceivably cuts in demand into the demand for Canadian supplies. And then Australia is also big on wheat and pulses, so they've got record wheat, barley, pea, chickpea crops. They're all big in Australia this year.
Do you see that affecting our acreage numbers at all?
Acreage numbers, I suppose it could affect our acreage numbers as far as tweaking what goes to one crop or the other, but I think for the most part, no, that it would be more an influence on the end price than on acres would be my quick take on that.
So it's looking like a lot tighter margins all the way around then.
That Yeah, that would be fair to say, yes.
Phil, what are the things we should be watching for in the next few weeks or so?
Next few weeks or so, I guess just keep an eye on South American weather and what the reports are out of there. The USDA has a report, I don't know the exact date, but within before the end of the month, they're coming out with their acreage, U.S. acreage ideas, and so that'll definitely be worth watching for what the indications are on soybeans versus corn in that seasonal acreage battle. Those are probably a couple big things to watch the next little while.
And of course, the big issue for a lot of people on the prairies this spring will be the fact that they've got saturated soil and in some cases crop left in the field. So seeding dates could be an issue for our guys this year.
Yeah, that's definitely a case on our end as well. The wet fields, and yeah, those fields that still have crops on them that need to come off will all have to be factored in as plans are made this spring.
Well, thanks, Phil, for coming on the show to talk about this.
You're welcome, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Phil Franz-Workington writes for Commodity News Service Canada. That's all we have for this week. Thanks for joining us on Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance.
We'd like to thank Gowan Canada, our sponsor for today's Between the Rows podcast. Remember, if you have Group 1 or 2 resistant wild oats on your farm, use Avidex or Fortress to control them. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. If you like what you heard on today's show and you want to hear more, go to membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.